week we have a live band performing in the studio that's from around here, and we'll even play your band on the show if you send us your CD. Tune in every Wednesday at 9 for the local music show.
Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper. Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper. While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around for a promotion. Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds.
Good afternoon. You've got Living Writers on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm T. Hetzel, and today I'm so excited to have here in the studio Peter Putnam. Peter, thank you so much for being here with your book, Talking About a Revolution, Growing Our Souls in the Time of Trump.
T, it's just great to be here and to hear that Tracy Chapman song. Ooh, yes.
Thanks for choosing the songs for today's program, Peter. And the Tracy Chapman song figures in pretty early on in the structure of the, well, it's in the title.
It's right there, yeah.
And in the primer, like we're just in the first few pages of your book. And then we get to hear a little bit more about the why the whisper is important.
Perfect. Yeah. The whisper, you know, and she even whispers when she's singing, you know, sounds like a whisper. And for my early revolutionary career, we'll talk about, you know, I was a professional revolutionary for 8 years, and I didn't understand or think about revolution as a whisper. We weren't doing any bombing or anything like that, but that quiet, still voice that came to me later, and it took years after I left that organization, left that what I call old school revolutionary thought, to come around to that whisper, and that whisper that we can actually call upon time and time again in our day-to-day life. It's not just an overt sort of political act that revolution for me means more, but something we're doing right now. I mean, conversation, dialogue, response.
And a whisper is powerful as well, especially if it's coming from like maybe a soul or a self opening into becoming who they can be, like you use the term best self.
Yes.
In here.
Yes.
You know what? Maybe we'll come back to best self, because there's what you do in Talking About a Revolution is you set up things so that folks can understand how you're defining your terms, and the book is it's a meaty tome. We've got like a big book on the table with us today, Peter, and got lots to talk about and to hear from you and your ideas and the passion that is throughout this book. Before we do that, I'll read your short bio on the book, as is our thing here. Peter Putnam is a former communist revolutionary and community college writing teacher and the author of The Song of Father Son, Men in Search of the Blessing. He lives in Detroit with his wife and co-founder of the James and Grace Lee Boggs School, Julia, and his two children, Henry and Lucy. And something just to note, here on your book here, Peter, you've done like a very generous thing that I think speaks to like community and the beliefs that are this book is all seems to be all about. And you have to contact Peter right there, actually in bigger letters than your biography, your email. Do you mind if I tell folks
please,
now who are listening? So to contact Peter, growingsouls2025 growingsouls@gmail.com. And Growing Souls 2025 is all one word. There's no spaces or underscore at gmail.com. And so, Peter, let's fill in a little more about your bio here. You were a professional revolutionary for 8 years, and the time marker sort of puts us at 1985. Is this where the story begins?
Yeah, I think so. My political biography is really kind of strange. I mean, I literally think I was the most naive political person in the country when I was an undergraduate. I knew nothing about politics. I love literature. I played a lot of sports. I'm not sure to this day whether my parents voted or not. We didn't talk about politics in our house. But when I...
Where were you in the country as an undergrad?
I was at Amherst College in Massachusetts. And first election I got a chance to vote in, I was a junior there. And I wasn't even going to vote. I didn't know who to vote for. It was the Jimmy Carter, Ronald Reagan election. And I was on the basketball team, and I was sitting at dinner with some of the players. And a friend of mine named Scott Flood said, you know, I said, Scott, I don't know anything. Should I vote? He goes, Peter, you got to vote. And I said, Scott, why? I don't even know who these two guys are. And he said, voting is the first step. And you don't know where you're going to go after that. And so I said, okay, Scott, I'll vote. And I just voted for Jimmy Carter because he seemed like the best guy. I mean, character-wise. I mean, that was totally based on no political understanding.
Did you want to have a beer with Jimmy Carter? No, I'm joking. That's a bad political allusion to a time in the future from that moment. But anyway.
Maybe with his – didn't he have – his brother was a beer drinker, right?
Yes,
I think back in the day. But he turned out to be a wonderful man. I'm not sure about his presidency as I look back on it now from a much more political place. But I found out as I wrote this book, he died as I was finishing this book up, Carter did. And when I was a professional revolutionary, I didn't have much respect or even I wasn't very aware of Jimmy Carter. He was irrelevant to what I was trying to do on a day-to-day basis to sort of build an organization that was going to, you know, eventually hopefully move through this capitalism onto something else. But the way he evolved and his decency and his ability to respond to the world post-presidency, when I think he was out of the constraints of all that, you know? He became, for me, you know, I think he was finally just a Southern liberal in terms of our political definition, but in terms of his soul, in terms of a guy who had a soul, I think in a way, I never would have said this 20 or 30 years ago, but he was a revolutionary by my perspective, by my new definition of somebody who responds to the world with your best self, you know, out of kindness and decency and integrity in all those virtues.
And so the best self, how did you come to that terminology? And it is capitalized in the book to set it apart, like the beloved community
exactly.
would be. So how did you come to really embrace this idea of the best self? Because there's many different ways, I guess, to come to this. Maybe just defining it a little bit more would be useful first of all, because it's about responding instead of reacting.
Exactly.
So thinking, maybe coming at it from that way, Peter.
Yeah, I think that's how I did eventually come up with that term, and also contrast it with capital beast self, our best self and our beast self. And I saw so much, we've all seen so much of the beast self in our public dialogue and coming from the top of our government, virtues, reaction, what I would call reactionary virtues of revenge and hatred and all that negative, horrific stuff. And the contrast to that, and I think we have both in us, which is sometimes hard to sort of, we don't want to admit that maybe, or I struggled with admitting that. But our best self is there, and that's the I guess the Jimmy Carter self, the kindness, the decency, the authenticity, the ability to listen, that we can hear each other's best self. Those virtues that they may be Christian, they may be Buddhist. I think they're universal. And I think we have that in us in some kind of way. And we can talk about soul. We can talk about, I'm a big Jungian, Carl Jung fan. And we can talk about capital S self. But I think it's there for us. And we've lost it a lot in this society. And we've turned and have been encouraged, I think, or sort of manipulated and enticed to turn towards our beast self. But we have that best self in us. And if we can step back from our beast self and respond, we have a chance. I think that's revolutionary, which sounds like, wow, really? Revolutionary? That's revolutionary? I think.
Yeah, taking a breath, taking a beat.
Yes.
Stepping back and not reacting in the moment, perhaps to something that angers you or that you feel is unjust or unfair.
Beautiful. Just like you just did right there, T, to slow me down a little bit and take a breath, you know? And if we do that, we have a chance of doing this, what we're doing right here across from each other. If we react, we set up a very different dynamic, a dynamic that gets worse and worse and is passed on. So our job, or at least I'd like to think my job is, on a day-to-day basis, with my son and my daughter. I've got a 20-year-old son and an 18-year-old daughter, and situations that come up with them, situations that come up when I'm walking down the street, when I'm driving a car, right? When I'm in at the house with my wife, Julia, all situations, there's possibility every single moment for a reaction or a response. And as much as I can, as much as we can, if we can take that breath and step into that response, into our best self, I think it's, again, a revolutionary act.
And that's what your book, Talking About a Revolution, Growing Our Souls in the Time of Trump, Peter, that's what it's saying at its core, is that it's a daily practice. It's a choice. It's not your one thing or another. It's a way of, if you want enough to connect to other human beings, yeah, or the environment, or to believe in the world, or to believe in humanity, you have a choice. And it's something that you have to keep making. It's not just,
exactly.
It's not just a one time you've acted, or you've gone to this protest, or you've, anyway.
Beautiful example. Yeah, even at a protest, right? We can be at a protest, and I've been at hundreds of them probably over my life. I don't know, dozens at least.
Yeah, from D.C., marching in D.C.
Exactly.
Yeah, Detroit, yeah.
All kinds of protests. But we can be at a protest, and we can have our signs, and we think that we're on the side of our best self, or we think we're on the right side. And yet, if we can be reactive there, we can still draw on beast values instead of our best values there. So it's not enough to read Marx. It's not enough to go to a protest. That's great. I think Marx has a lot to teach us. I think protests are wonderful. October 18th, there's one coming up. So I'll be out there somewhere in Detroit. So that's good stuff. And the energy there is powerful often.
But what is the October 18th one, Peter?
It's another one of the No Kings.
Oh, yes.
Things. Okay. I was at the last one in Southwest Detroit. I live in Detroit, and I went to the one in Detroit, and I think there'll be another one there. So I'll go to that, and I'll do my best to also be my best, to bring my best self there. And a lot of times on the left or the far left, and certainly a lot of times I see on the far right, people who are very passionate and think that they're drawing on something because they're passionate isn't sufficient for me in terms of going forward, evolving, the society. We have to not only be passionate, but we also have to be aware of where is our energy coming from. Is it coming from that best place or some other place?
Peter, let's take a short break and then we'll return. We'll be back today on Living Writers. Peter Putnam is here. I'm T. Hetzel. I want to do a shout out to George Cooper. Thank you, George, for connecting Peter and I. His book, Talking About a Revolution, Growing Our Souls in the Time of Trump. We'll be back. Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, you're in time for Living Writers. And today, Peter Putnam is here in the studio, the book on the table with us, Peter's book, Talking About a Revolution, Growing Our Souls in the Time of Trump. So, Peter, why the song that we just got a chance to hear part of?
I got a chance to do a semester abroad in England. I went to a teacher's college for a semester, Goldsmiths College, and I live with eight British blokes, and they're very musically inclined, and I was still a little bit sort of musically sort of naive, and they introduced me to Elvis Costello, and that song and Allison, actually, too, those two songs blew me open and introduced me to a whole new musical sort of scene, I guess. And that song is just really cool because it originally was written by a guy named Nick Lowe. And he originally sort of tongue-in-cheek, but Elvis in the late 70s sort of turned it into a real he's serious. And, you know, why not peace, love, and understanding? What's wrong with that? And he's got a punk attitude, and the video is great. But he's not tongue-in-cheek there. You know, really, what's so funny about peace, love, and understanding? Why can't we move through the world with peace, love, and understanding? And with a little bit of a punk attitude, too.
Yeah, that always helps.
Yeah, exactly.
It really does always help. Before the break, you were mentioning this idea of, like, what it takes, like, why it's important to cultivate the best, responding with the best self in community, because that's a way of moving forward into the future instead of being just on a loop or what seems like going backwards in some ways. And so this word evolving and evolution, it reminds me of one of the people that you call upon quite a lot throughout Talking About a Revolution, Grace Lee Boggs.
Yes, yes.
Who was so critical in your own becoming for this part of your revolutionary life, Peter. Is there, because Grace would write revolution with evolution bounded, like the right, like
with the R, yes. So it's both, you know, it's a dialectic back and forth. You know, the first part of the book's title comes from Tracy Chapman. We started out with her, and the second part really comes from Grace. You know, she would say, it's just, I think in the next 3 days, it'll be 10 years since she's passed. She lived to be 100 years old.
It's 10 years already.
10 years, yeah. She said a lot down the stretch of her life. Now is it time to grow our souls. Now is a great time to grow our souls. And
that's your lead. That's your way into the book. That's your epigraph here.
Yes, yes. And I think it's, you know, I never would have used the word soul back in my old school revolutionary days. But I use it now, and I don't know exactly. I mean, we can get metaphysical here. I don't know, but it speaks to me in a way that I think is important, and it's another way of talking about our best self. Now is the time to grow, evolve, revolve our best self, our soul self, because we need that. We can't do what we need to do in this world. We can't build the world, like you said, T, beyond this world if we're not doing it now in some kind of way.
The practice of it.
The practice. Yes, thank you for that. It was in writing this book that I finally, the idea of revolution as a practice hit me. You know, it was like, wow, it is. It's a day-to-day thing like you were talking about. It's a minute-to-minute thing. It's not just going out in front of a plant, which I did a lot of as an old-school revolutionary. It's not just reading Marx. It's not just going to a protest. It's a day-to-day, minute-by-minute, person-by-person, situation-by-situation reality that we have, as you put it so nicely. We have a choice to make that a practice in our lives.
Yeah, because it could be as simple as walking down the street or mm-hmm. being in, like you say, being in a coffee shop and
Absolutely.
How you respond to people. Yes, every moment is an opportunity, or with your family.
Absolutely.
And
indoors or outdoors, right? You know, public or private, it doesn't really end, and it can, and we can't be perfect, you know, in terms of.
Thanks for saying that, because I was going to say that sounds also kind of overwhelming.
It is
as a practice, then.
Mm-hmm. It can be, and I think another realization that came to me as I was writing is that okay, sometimes we're going to react, sometimes we're going to react. To our 18-year-old daughter, to our 20-year-old son. But we always have the possibility, if we have in mind the idea that we have a choice in the next situation, that we can respond. And one of the virtues, I think one of the best self virtues is apology, which we sometimes need, right? And so if I yell at Lucy, I need to come back when I can, when I become grounded again, my wife talks about being on her square, right? She's a principal and founder of the co-founder of the Bog School. If I'm back on my square, I can go to Lucy and say, hey, I'm sorry, I messed up, I lost it, you know, can we have a do-over? And so we always have even after a reaction, we have the possibility of responding. And that's part of the practice as well. Not to be overwhelmed, not to be perfect, to know that we have a response in our back pocket.
And maybe also then, if we're granting that understanding to ourselves, which can be very difficult, but also remembering to grant it to others, that they are also going to be, even if we're trying to be our best selves, others are going to also react or not take a beat when that might be good. Or
exactly.
And
exactly.
So just trying to bring that more into, which is more into being, which is hard in our culture that seems to be conditioning us to propel us forward and to rush and to constantly be keeping time on the clock and producing something to show some kind of value instead of being.
Oh, you're so right, T. You know, you had a Ross Gay on a couple of years back, and he talked about it was another interview you did with upstate New York writer, his name is slipping. That's okay. It'll come to me. But he talked about if art has done anything for us or demanded anything of us in the last 2,000 or 3,000 years, it's to slow down. That somehow art is an attempt by artists, whether they're writers or painters, musicians, to slow us down. And that gives us that opportunity to take that beat, to sort of step back from our reactive self or somebody else reacting towards us and put our best self forward, put our revolutionary self forward by responding.
Let's go back to Grace Lee Boggs. Because,
okay, yes.
I'll try to jump us through a part of your story, because we know that you were an undergrad at in Massachusetts.
Yes, yes.
And then you came here for grad school.
I did. I was at University of Michigan.
And what years? When were you here?
83 till 89.
So it actually happened here on campus when you were becoming revolutionary and investigating the political, what that means politically for you. And then there were eight years of living this way with these beliefs at your core. And then that was shaken from you.
Yes.
And what do you do when your identity, something that's in your core, what you believe about how the world should work or how a professional revolutionary's role in the work of the world or the action that needs to take place. Like, what's it like when that changes for you?
Well, great question. And for me, I describe in the book, and it still feels like the right word, it felt like a divorce. It was my identity to a great extent, and I thought it was going to be my identity for the rest of my life. I had no doubt when I made that commitment at 25 to be a revolutionary that I would be doing that until I was, 85 if I made it that far. And so it was a devastating blow. I still had the ideas. I still have almost all those ideas in terms of how to analyze the world, what I needed to figure out. And it took me a long time, and Grace was so instrumental in that, to sort of come back to that soul, that soul element, which I never really completely lost. You know, I grew up in a home that had certain best self values, I think, and I'd read a lot of philosophy, and I'd gone through sort of a Christian stage, a mini Buddhist stage. I knew there was something else other than a dialectical materialist perspective that Marx and Trotsky talk about, that there was something that maybe they couldn't put their fingers on. And it took me a while to sort of figure out decades, to figure out how to make that part of my identity as well, without losing all that revolutionary life gave me. I wouldn't trade it for anything. I mean, I learned so much. Maybe there's somebody listening out in Berkeley who was the one who convinced me here in the fishbowl. Well, we had many discussions after that, but when I first bumped into him in the fishbowl and said, "Hey, are you interested in revolutionary politics?" From that time on, I grew a ton in those 8 years, and I did things and thought things and read things I never would have encountered. So I don't want to turn my back on that, and I don't think I have. But I knew there was something for me anyway missing. And Grace,
in your evolution.
In my own, yes, exactly. In my evolution. And Grace was one of those folks. And my wife, too, we met through Grace, actually. And watching her go through the world as well was another.
Watching Julia go through the world because you met at Detroit Summer.
We did, yes.
Which was started by Jimmy Boggs and Grace Lee Boggs.
Yes, thank you for bringing Jimmy into the conversation as well. I didn't get to meet Jimmy. I missed him by 2 weeks. He passed away in July of 1993, and I met Grace in early August of 93.
And it's so striking to me that she welcomed you instantly into her home, even 2 weeks. Like, I can just imagine this, the grief that she must have been experiencing, but the value she places on revolution, evolution, is such that she said, she used it as a way to introduce you to Jimmy Boggs and his ideas as well as her own.
Well said. I called her. I called them up. I was, again, struggling back to the identity crisis. I was in Detroit at that point, and I didn't know what to do. And I read an interview with the two of them, and it was just amazing. I said, I have never thought this way about revolutionary politics before. Who are these people? And I looked up their number in the phone book back in the days when we had phone books, and I called over to their house, and Grace answered, and I told her briefly that I was in sort of a revolutionary crisis, I guess. It's just, you need to come over. And so I did that day, and she invited me into her living room and wheeled out a TV and said, you've got to watch this. And it was a little bit of Jimmy Boggs talking to, I think, students here at U of M, actually. He spoke several times at U of M. And
as has Grace,
exactly. Yes. So that was my introduction to Grace. That was my introduction to Jimmy. And eventually it was going to be down the line three years, I think, from there, my introduction to my wife. So it was a good day at the Boggs house.
And did you return to that living room many times?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's a famous living room, you know. Malcolm X has been in that living room. Danny Glover, who's an activist, so a whole lot of folks, as well as a lot of community folks, you know, not just famous revolutionaries or activists, but just, you know, it was a place that people on the east side of Detroit came to and expected and believed in what the Boggses were doing. Even if they weren't revolutionaries themselves, Jimmy in particular was just a, you know, auto worker from the South who was incredibly gifted both intellectually and socially. And so it became a hub, you know, for people in that community.
Well, I would argue, Peter, from your book, anyone who entered into that living room was a revolutionary seeking their best self and seeking ways to respond to the world that as they were finding it to both survive it and to change it.
Wow. Yes, I think people might not have realized that, but once you cross the threshold there...
For you, there was no turning back.
No. And it was... I think that's accurate. I mean, there's still an energy there. The Boggs Center is wonderful. I opened my book, when it first came out in February.
Was that your launch?
Yes, it was. The launch was at the Boggs Center, and it was so much fun. It's a great place. We weren't in the living room, but there's a wonderful upstairs space. And so, that was the launch of Talking About Revolution.
Ah, you couldn't think of a better place and an energy to be in. Let's take a short break. When we come back, Peter Putnam will be still here, thank goodness, for the second half of our conversation today, talking about a revolution, growing our souls in the time of Trump. I'm T. Hetzel. We've got Jason behind the glass. We'll be back.
Truth is, I thought it mattered. I thought that music mattered. But does it bollocks? Not compared to how people matter.
We'll be singing when we're winning. We'll be singing.
I get knocked down, but I get up again. You're never gonna keep me down. I get knocked down, but I get up again.
Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, so glad you did. Today, Peter Putnam is here in the studio. His book, Talking About a Revolution, Growing Our Souls in the Time of Trump. Peter, I want to ask you about what it took to get this book out into the world. Because this book is this, correct me if I'm wrong on any of this, you chose to self-publish this.
I did.
Using Amazon as a vehicle.
Yeah, reluctantly, but yes.
But okay, would you mind sharing a little bit about like what led you to these choices? Because these are your ideas and beliefs, and it's a timely moment. And sometimes the publishing world doesn't move in that way as quickly. Like sometimes it can be a slow process, etc. I'm interested to know about your experience, and then how you were able to come to this so the book could be in the world for that launch back in February of 2025.
Yeah. It was, I wrote the book in 4 months. I was just finishing up another book that I've been working on for 7 years. And I was actually proofreading that when I went to a meeting, my daughter's a nutritionist, and she mentioned respond versus react in terms of Lucy, okay, here you have your choice, respond versus react in different situations. And I thought right there in that session, I can put together 30 years of thought around that spine. And so that night was July 8th, 2025. I went home and started writing the book.
Or 20, wait.
In this 2024, excuse me.
Oh, thank you.
Excuse me. Yeah, that's right. We're not there yet. I'm evolving too fast. 2024. And started writing the book that night. Wrote about a month, and then Kamala Harris entered the race, and it looked like she might win. And I thought, oh, I don't know. I'm really working on this, finishing this other book up. And so I took a break for a couple of months. And then when she didn't win, I immediately went back to the book November 6th, I think, you know, the day after the election, and was hoping to get it done by January, by Inauguration Day. That was my goal. It was a month later than that. And I had no real alternative because of what you said in terms of timeliness. I wanted this book out. I wanted it to be structured the way I structured it, which there's a lot of space here, right? And I originally had the idea of it perhaps being a sort of a day-to-day sort of thing where each...
Or like each, a user manual.
Exactly. Yes.
With poems.
Yes, throw a poem. I love poetry, so there were some poems by myself and other folks. And it would be sort of a day-to-day sort of thing. And you could flip it, and May 5th, there would be this. And that finally didn't make sense and didn't work structurally, but I
maybe had too many constraints. Like you mentioned about Jimmy Carter and the presidency. Maybe it was something, this needed to be more open.
I think so. And things were happening, like Jimmy Carter's death, and things were happening. And Leo, the person who's killed the CEO, Luigi Mangione, that happened in the middle of writing this. And I have several pieces on that to try to work through that. So there was things happening. And I knew by the time, if I could get a publisher for something like this, I wouldn't be able to have it published the way I wanted to structurally. And it wouldn't be out for a year, year and a half, if you're lucky. So I chose that. It was difficult. Amazon is not, you know, something that I want to promote. Fortunately, right now it's available at, there's a wonderful bookstore in Detroit called 27th Letter.
Yes.
And a great place with wonderful books, progressive stuff. So it's available there. But the choice I made.
And so if folks, if you're in Detroit, 27th Letter.
Yes. A book, Michigan Avenue, 27th Letter.
You could get a copy of the book.
Absolutely.
And you could also ask your local bookstore to stock it. Is that possible, Peter? Or would it then be the individual would then, you could go to Amazon and you would buy
it? You
can
definitely
book.
Buy it, obviously.
Printed
at
in
Amazon.
Cleveland.
Exactly.
Helping Cleveland. Yeah.
There we go. And also my wife and I are doing an author talk at the Detroit Public Library.
What date?
Next Sunday, the 12th of October.
October 12th.
2 p.m. And 27th Letter will have books there. And it's the main branch right there on Woodward. Beautiful building right across from the DIA. So there's another opportunity to hear more of us and hear more of you, as you know, whoever wants to come and talk about a little bit of revolution and what that means.
When you have these events, Peter, when you're organizing them, is it to grow the community so that the voices, like you'll be talking about the book and that will be the frame, but are you hoping that people will speak up, will engage? What would you like from that October 12th event at the Detroit Public Library?
I think what I'd like just for the book itself and for any public event is for people to sort of understand that they have that choice that we've talked about several times. They can respond instead of react. And in that way, they can evolve, grow their own souls, and I think grow our democracy, or what will become a democracy. And so there's always that opportunity, and there would be opportunity at that event for us to respond to each other, audience and myself and my wife. And there's always those opportunities, as we've talked about. So that would be I think that's what people that I've talked to about the book come away with. They say, oh yeah, I like this response thing. You know, that's, I can get that. I can grasp that. Some of the other stuff, and it's there about the state, about the 99% versus the 1%. That's all there. And I think it's a helpful analysis. But on a day-to-day basis, most Americans right now, if we can just think about responding to our neighbors, our family, to the TV set or our social media.
Our colleagues,
yes, in workplaces, exactly.
Yes, because it's a way of acting in the moment. that gives can give you hope. It can give you a direction or a path. Because sometimes it can feel like there aren't many things that you can do, or sometimes I think it's things might be designed to have this feeling of increased powerlessness, as many, you know, federal departments are being, you know, people are losing, so many people are losing their jobs by the month, and things that have taken a long time to build up, in many ways, like for better or worse, I was going to say, but that do care about things like the environment or the Veterans Administration or any of these number of things that we have for a reason too. It can feel like things are just changing so quickly in a short time, that may not be in service of our community, let alone a beloved community. And so bringing it to this day to day, what you can do is an act of hope.
I love that. And again, that's one of those best self virtues, I think, that we have to have that hope. And I think to respond in the world as best we can, as often as we can, is an antidote to the despair that so many of us are feeling, you know?
That's and, it. Even yeah. more than hope. I know that might be the flip side of it, but that feeling that you can have, this is one way to help transform it.
Yes. And it might not jump all the way to hope.
No.
You know?
That's what I mean. Yes. I think that was reaching too far there. So
but it's a step.
For being...
No. It's a great step. It's a step in the direction, right? And we can't jump sometimes energetic levels, you know, but we can take that step. And it's different from the step towards more despair or towards more cynicism. And so it's a step that we can make and we can choose to make. And regardless of what the federal government is doing, we still have that freedom to do that, and also utilize any other freedoms we have, including what we're doing right now, freedom of speech. But, you know, in a very, very small but significant way, sort of in the world of quantum mechanics, that step, you know, that little step, the butterfly effect, right? Chaos theory. We can move towards something that that's bigger and eventually more hopeful than we're living right now.
And you keep your eye on that in this book too, because you say there's that it could be like this time that we're in, but you have to be ready. And what can you do if you've been, you know, beaten down or so, or told that you have no power or no. But whatever it is that can feel that way, and so to have this to be ready connects to the practice of trying this just as an individual for your own life, for your community.
Yeah, you know, I love that word ready. I'm a big Hamlet fan. And when I was in grad school, I tried to get Hamlet into every paper I wrote, something about Hamlet. But he says at one point late in the play, the readiness is all, you know?
Yes.
So
I remember that too, Peter.
So, yeah, I think
a while.
It is our readiness, you know, that we are practicing again. And that's allowing us to be more ready. And in this time period... There's a lot of pressure to react. And so if we can be ready and respond, there's power in that.
Yes. Instead of feeling the powerlessness.
Exactly.
That in some ways, maybe we're like, maybe there's some conditioning that is hoping that people will feel powerless.
I think it's there. Yeah.
Become more passive or, and in some ways, what I also love about talking about a revolution is that was like an instinct of my own was to go kind of, and I think for many folks I can't say that actually, let me take that back. I'll just speak myself here, but like to kind of go closer in, to try to cope or to manage. And that can feel in a way like, in some ways cowardly. If we think of revolution as standing at the barricades or moving the barricades actually now that has a totally different imagery to me. I think more of, you know, like January 6th, like images that aren't aren't so good as thinking like Les Miserables. Let's take the fight to them. But it's so you can feel kind of, or I did feel badly about that. Mm-hmm. Like, am I not standing up enough, or are these small actions enough, like showing up at protests and or donating when you can to different groups to try to keep things afloat, or GoFundMes, there things have been taken from folks, or but actually reframing it to say, no, this is the work, like, to actually, like, so that you are ready. It can't just be turning like snap
flipping
of
a switch, thing. Right? Yeah. No, I love the reframing idea, and that's it's simple as that. And what we can what we're moving towards, I hope, as we evolve, as you've mentioned it maybe twice now, the beloved community. How do we build the beloved community? We can't flip a switch on that. You know, we need to be the people we want to see now, as best we can. And in doing that, we begin to, in any interaction we have, move in the direction of, again, we can't jump to it just like we couldn't maybe jump to hope, but we can move towards the beloved community. And
could you say a couple of words about the beloved community?
Yeah, you know, it comes, Martin Luther King sort of was moved by that. That was his goal. And I think it's a wonderful idea because it's tied in with the idea of growing our souls. That beloved community comes when we make the decisions from our best self to move in the direction of growing our souls, to figure out how to connect with people rather than turn away from people, to figure out how to love people instead of the hatred that we get spewed at a lot these days. And so the beloved community is a place where we will finally have a chance, all of us, to grow ourselves, not just our souls, but our minds and our bodies in ways that under this system, capitalism, we're so restricted in so many ways. Even myself, a straight, white, middle-class male, is restricted by this society, much less if you're a black woman trying to make ends meet. So in the beloved community, we'll have a chance to connect and to grow in ways that this society doesn't allow.
And I really appreciate that you say all of us with emphasis, mm-hmm. With an understanding that each person has the chance to be becoming. We're not static creatures. Mm-hmm. That idea of, I think you have maybe midway through the structure of the book, creators versus activists, or activists versus creators. Could you say a little bit about this, Peter?
Oh, yes. I think we can, I sort of consider myself an activist, and even in the word itself, there's action already, which is fine, but where are we acting from? What's the energy behind that activism? It can be reactionary. We can get to a protest and start yelling and screaming and cursing, and maybe sometime you need to do that. But most of the time, before we act, are we grounded? Before we act, are we on our square? Before we act, are we in some way connected to our best self? And out of that, if we think more about being creators rather than activists, we'll act differently because we'll understand the connection to creation. And so, you know, it's maybe subtle, maybe not subtle, but for me, I think we're all built to create. I think that's what we're here to do. And
making something, building
something, including the beloved community.
Yes.
You know, making something individually and making a contribution beyond ourselves that moves us in the direction of the beloved community. And so if we think ourselves as creators, I think we can still do the activism, but we do it from a different place with a different energy.
Yes. And I mean, that's hard, because I would say it's interesting to think of that, because activists, like if that is part of your identity or what one of your part of your belief system, it's almost hard to move past that in a way, to see that you, like you had just said so well, if you are a creator, you are also activist. As an activist, you would be a creator as well. But sometimes if you're an activist, it might not be towards the beloved community or so.
Yeah, I think you can get stuck. You know, I think activists can get stuck. Heart might be in our in the right place, but we still have to grow. Even, you know, even if our ideas, like I still have many of the same ideas that I had as an old school revolutionary. And yet, you know, there's more to me now, I think. And there's that soul element, that self element that came out of therapy and Jungian psychology and parenthood and all of that. Men's movement, men's work, I've done a lot of that. So that brings another dimension to our activism and another dimension to who we are, because we have to evolve too. No matter, even if we think we have the best ideas in the world, righteousness is problematic. Righteousness is often a reactionary sort of beast, whether, you know, fundamentalism, whether it's from the Christian or Muslim or left or right. It's a stuck position, and we need to evolve.
It's a closing down.
Rather than
or closing up. Off or
both, I think. Closing down, closing off. Yeah, exactly.
So, Peter, it's so easy to talk with you. Thank you for this wonderful conversation.
Likewise.
We've got your book on the table with us. Before we go, would there be a part of it, because we talked about it's an unusual book. Its structure, it mixes personal narrative, lists, resources, poems,
a little bit of everything.
Yeah.
Smorgasbord, yes.
Yeah. Is there a part that you, or parts that you would want to turn to, or, and is it a book maybe that you could even open at random and see what that page held for you to think about for the day?
Wow, that's so tempting. And I'm such a preparer.
Oh, and no, to you open, do it. You do you.
Oh, my gosh.
Whatever.
No, I promised myself to be as spontaneous as I could. But I think I do want to end with, or is it possible? It's the last, one of the last essays in the book, or last pieces in the book. Is it possible? I couldn't even finish the heading. So preposterous, so outrageous, so insensitive does what I'm about to say sound. Is it possible that Trump's election in the next 4 years are the best thing could have happened to America? Hear me out. Whatever horrific divisions exist in America were not caused by Trump. That Trump brought these divisions, this racism and sexism and other isms to the surface, brought them to a hatred-fueled head. Yes, that seems indisputable. But they were there long, long before he ever took office, even the first time. Some, the deepest, have been there since this country's beginnings. So here they are now, ugly, raw, all band-aids off, and in the presence of these now undeniable gaping wounds, who are we? What will we do? Is it possible that up until now, with the exception of the Civil War, we Americans, most of us anyway, have not come face to face with what we must face if we are to become a truly great nation? Is it possible that we now recognize we cannot depend on politicians, however well-intended, to save us from the choices we have all made, the America we have all created? Is it possible that revolutionaries like Rosa Parks, Eugene Debs, Fannie Lou Hamer, Dorothy Day, the Berrigan brothers, James Baldwin, Harriet Tubman, Martin and Malcolm, Grace and Jimmy, Bishop Merriam Buddy, and thousands of others whose names are less known, but were also revolutionaries in their private and public lives, is it possible that these Americans have shown us a way to live our lives with dignity and courage, to grow our humanity, our souls, despite the humanity that surrounds us? Is it possible that we too, each of us, can live our best life, the life of our best self in the time of Trump? Is it possible that when confronted with falsehood, we speak truth? When encountering cruelty, we respond with empathy? When faced with hatred, we offer love? Can we connect, reconnect, newly connect? Can we make apologies, amends, reparations? Can we create sacred rituals of peace, circles of sharing and restoration, spaces of play? Is it possible that we are the leaders we have been waiting for, that though the word may scare us, may feel too big for what we perceive as our small, powerless lives, we are the revolutionaries who are here and alive and ready to respond to the illegalities, immoralities, and cruelties of Trump time, with the strength and creativity of our best self, and to lead our fellow workers, our neighbors, our friends, our families, our communities, our nation to the free, dignified, diverse, prosperous, peace-filled world that we've envisioned and that we all deserve? Is that possible? I think so.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you, Dee.
Was that the last thing you wrote for the book?
Huh. It was, if not the last, one of the last pieces, yeah.
Can you remember that moment?
I remember realizing that the power of just that, is it possible? And also the outrageousness of that, like to sort of connect that, like how could anybody of my sort of political, sort of stripe consider the Trump time to be a great time for revolution, or that, you know, that we could grow something powerful out of this time? It's, again, easy for me to say as a white middle-class male, right? It's been a hell of a difficult time for a lot of people, less so for me. And so when I first thought to write that piece near the end of this book, I didn't know whether it was fair to write that piece. Because I know what people are suffering in this. I have some idea of what people are suffering. I live in Detroit. I see it there. I watch the news. I see it there. How can I write that? You know, how preposterous, and worse than preposterous, how, I don't know, ignorant or hypocritical, or, you know. So it took me a while, I think, to sort of work up the nerve to play that out, to write it out, and then see if I could, if it was okay to sort of put in the book. Or was it too preposterous, too hypocritical, too much of a person from my background being able to sort of say that without understanding the implications?
But you decided that it belongs in the book, and it belongs in a place, a powerful place in the book as well.
Yeah, you know, and partly is I liked the rhetoric of it without being rhetoric, you know, just the sound of it, and that I thought that it would do something. It was a good rejoicing, even though it was problematic.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you. A good rejoicing. Peter Putnam, talking about a revolution, growing our souls in the time of Trump. You can go and hear Peter and Julia talking about a revolution, growing our souls in the time of Trump at the Detroit Public Library on October 12th at 2 p.m. Thanks, everyone out there, for listening, for keeping on, keeping on. Thanks very much, Peter Putnam, for being here today and talking. Thanks to Jason for engineering. Thanks to Mom for listening out there, and everyone out there for listening. Until next time.
One, two, three, four. Out of the muddy clay, I would sing, sing a new song. I will sing, sing a new song. How long to sing this song? How long to sing this song?
Telephone from the Oval Room at the White House. And as you talk to us from the Sea of Tranquility, it inspires us to redouble our efforts to bring peace and tranquility to Earth. For one priceless moment in the whole history of man, all the people on this Earth are truly one.
WCDN FM Ann Arbor. keeping Richard Nixon's vision of peace and global unity alive with sounds and music from all the cultures of all the people all over the world.
What do you call it, music at the restaurants or on the elevators? That music is destructive. That music, if we had good music playing for people in a happy society on the streets, you know? I feel like my music, I have a new record coming out. I feel like, well, maybe this time they'll hear it.
Live from Ann Arbor, welcome back to the Daily Sports Report here on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm your host, Vihan Iswar, bringing you an NFL Sunday, NFL Tuesday, I'm sorry, I don't know where I am, on a Wednesday, because yesterday could not host the show, had to make up an econ quiz at 6 p.m., but you're here, you're getting your dose of NFL Sunday content. I'm joined by a full panel consisting of Luca, Charlie, Bowen, and Seth. Seth, how's everyone doing?
Good.
Good, good. As always, we're going to start the show off with a bit of an icebreaker, and, you know, we've talked about a couple of different things. I think last week, the icebreaker was a movie that you think everybody should watch, but I really like music, so I'll just lead us off with a music question. Desert Island, you can only listen to three albums. Which three albums are you going to take?
That's a good question. I can go first. I'm going to go A Good Kid, Mad City by Kendrick Lamar.
Fantastic.
Guts by Olivia Rodrigo. Okay. And I'm going to do a K-pop album here. I'm going to do Whiplash by aespa.
Yeah, I can definitely speak on the Good Kid, Mad City and Guts picks. I really enjoy those two albums. In the case of Good Kid, Mad City, I don't know if it's my favorite Kendrick album, but it would definitely be on my shortlist.
I guess I can pop in next. I'll go the self-titled 1975 by The 1975. I'll go Nothing Happens by Wallows. And I'm going to steal the Guts pick, too. I mean, it's just such an incredible album. It doesn't get much better than that.
My favorite 1975 album is actually their most recent one, Being Funny in a Foreign Language, because that one has O Caroline.